Thank you, Fred. My name is Midge McFadden, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Midge.
Hi. My, that sounded nice. First of all, I want to thank the committee for the very great honor they have bestowed on me by inviting me to participate in this fabulous 20th Ohio State Convention. Is everybody having as good a time as I am?
Yeah.
Oh, it really is terrific, and I'm loving every minute of it. And I also want to thank you very, very much for the special brand of Ohio hospitality that has been bestowed on me since Fred met the plane. He said it was an honor. If I'd been standing out there and he hadn't shown up, I don't know what I'd have called it. But it was an honor for me to find the people who were meeting us, and it was really great. It was a very nice, warm reception. When I was first invited by the chairman of this convention, Bob, that I've known for several years, to come out here, I did something that I should have known better than to do. This was several months ago. And one of the first things I learned in AA was this was the daily program, and that we live a day at a time. So I immediately started projecting. I had some very close, warm, loving ties to Ohio. One of my twin sons graduated 2 years ago from Ohio Northern University in Ada. I was there at his graduation, of course. He subsequently got a job in Chardon, bought a mobile home, and he was all nicely set. Everything was going along beautifully. He was engaged to a girl, a local gal. I had met her and her family. So I thought, well, now I'll leave on Sunday afternoon after the convention. I'll ask Lee, my son, to come up to Cleveland and meet me. We'll drive back to Chardon. I'll stay with him Sunday night, Monday and Monday night, then go back to New York, have a chance to visit again with his fiancée and her parents. And I had figured out there were a few little problems involved, and I had gone into quite detail about what I was going to say, what I was going to do, et cetera, et cetera. When I left home yesterday, the son I was going to visit in Chardon is in New Jersey. A couple of months ago, more or less, in the space of a week's time, the girl broke the engagement and he lost his job. So that's what happens when you project. The story does have a little happier ending than that. That sounds a little bleak. The young man has weathered the emotional crisis he went through surprisingly well, and I'm very, very proud of him. Plus the fact he has gotten another excellent job in New Jersey, with unemployment being what it is, I'm proud of that too. And he is temporarily, at least, living back at home with Mama and Papa. And this is working out very, very happily since I learned several years ago to treat him as an adult, not as a child. So we have a very warm, very loving relationship. I don't always approve of everything he says and does, but he probably doesn't approve of everything I say and do. So it's working out very, very nicely. But that's just a little lesson I wanted to pass along in projecting. In other words, don't. We never can tell, and they've told me this since day one, what tomorrow is going to bring. So let's enjoy today. And this very day, for me, is a beautiful, beautiful day to enjoy. I also had my plans very carefully drawn for exactly what I was going to say and what I was going to talk about. I heard several other people this weekend say the same thing. Fortunately, I left all my notes back in New Jersey, which is just where they belong. Since I came out here, I have been asked to do a couple of other things that I had not planned to do, so the notes wouldn't have done me any good anyway. I got myself an Ohio sponsor yesterday, because I thought that would be a good thing to do, by the name of Ann, and I'm sure you all know what Ann I mean. And Ann very definitely told me last night what to do today. She said, tell your story. Now, when your sponsor tells you what to do, you do what she says. She didn't ask me, she didn't suggest, and I have witnesses to this. She said, tell your story. So here goes. I had my first drink when I was 16. It was given to me by my dad, and he could do no wrong anyway, in my eyes. And it was at a family Sunday cocktail party, which were par for the course in our home. My family and my grandparents were all social drinkers, not even really what I would call heavy drinkers. And I'm not what I call heavy drinkers today. And I grew up seeing alcohol used socially nicely. I do not recall seeing any drunkenness of any kind in our home by my family or their friends. Drinking was really a mark of distinction. And when Daddy gave me that cocktail glass on that Sunday, I felt that I had grown up. I was now an accepted member of the family. You see, even then, alcohol assumed a proportion in my mind which wasn't valid. It should not have, but it did. Unbeknownst to me, I was even then a sitting duck for alcoholism. That drink changed my day, and I really believe changed my life. When I say I was a sitting duck for alcoholism, I think 16-year-old girls, at least in my generation, they seem to be pretty sophisticated and have their feet on the ground today, but in my generation, we didn't. I was all gangly arms and long neck and stringy hair. My mother, lovingly, I hope, used to call me her ugly duckling, and she told me on many occasions that I was a very homely girl. I thought I was the homeliest thing God had ever created. She had a good reason for doing this, but I didn't understand that until I was many, many years older. And this hurt me, and it hurt me very deeply, though I must confess it was true. I was pathologically shy to begin with, and then add this to that. And I was really not much. I was so shy, and I was so conscious of my homely face, that I would walk to high school with my nose down watching my shoes. If I were walking along the street and happened to see somebody, I would cross the street because it wasn't I didn't want to speak to them, but I thought they didn't want to speak to me. Nobody wanted to see my ugly face. And I really believed this. Well, enter this one drink on this Sunday. And it was pink, rather insipid. I have no idea whether it had a name or not. I drank it, and something happened. The nose was no longer pointed to the ground, but the chin went up, and I strutted around the room like a princess. I talked to people. I found I could talk to people quite easily. There was one dear friend of Daddy's that I had some joke or quip I wished to share with him, and I did, and he laughed. And there was a nice sound to his laugh. He was not laughing at me. He was laughing with me. And I couldn't recall that having happened before. I did not have another drink that day. I went to bed that night, and I thought, aha, that is how all these people get along so easily socially. This is the way you do it. The magic is in that liquid. And so I decided that any time that I was going to be involved in any social events, I was also going to be equipped with the magic key, and this I proceeded to do. Now, I would have told you at that stage in my life, having very loving and very permissive parents, that I was my own boss and that I made my own decisions. Fully, I didn't. I didn't at all. Alcohol made my decisions. Alcohol decided who I'd go with and where I would go and what I would do. And I lost out on a great many of the finer things of life, like concerts and symphonies and et cetera, because alcohol wasn't available at those places. And perhaps the people who went weren't drinking people. And so I shunned those affairs. And I turned up my nose at the squares who didn't drink. It was a very long time before I actually got into any trouble with alcohol. And my story is one of very, very gradual, very long, and rather somewhat dull progression, and so I'm going to skip. In 1942, I married in California, and it will come as no surprise to you that I married a man who drank, and he drank more than I did, which was absolutely great. Now I'm away from school, I'm away from my parents, I'm away from any kind of supervision, and I'm out in a small town in California where they think they're going to be bombed any minute, and they can't do enough for these army boys and the few brides who are around. And this included buying us drinks. So you could go into a bar the night before payday with 15 cents in your pocket and come out with a dollar and a half change and drunk. It was a pretty good routine, and we used it. We used it a lot. And it was fun. It really was. A lot of it was fun. But I began to notice even then that the mornings were pretty grim. And because Army pay was pretty low then, I got a job, and I found a little difficulty in some mornings in making it. But make it I did, because that was a point of honor. The word alcoholism I never heard mentioned in any connection by anybody for years and years and years. Anyway, during the balance of the war, he went overseas, and at the time he left, we had left from Houston, Texas. And I stayed there, and I lived with a family in Houston, and they were wonderful to me, and I had a fine job there, and really a very nice life, except I kind of loused it up because I had to drink every night. I was by this time a daily drinker. Now, I was drinking for all the wrong reasons from the very beginning. I was drinking at the suggestion of a doctor to increase my appetite, to help me sleep. I wish I had to increase my appetite now, no problem. To help me sleep and to calm my nerves. Oh, that's a beaut. I went to more doctors about calming my nerves. And fortunately, this was before the days of tranquilizers, for which I shall be very grateful. But drinking was most acceptable as a medication for that, and I used it. And so when I was left alone, I got a beautiful case of poor meitis, because, you see, this was a good excuse, and anybody could understand. My husband's over fighting the Battle of the Bulge, and here's poor me all alone in Houston, you know. And so I would bring home a bottle of wine every night and consume it quietly in my own room. A great deal of my drinking was done alone, and it was done quietly, and the harm it did to me was inside. I didn't strike out at people. I was so afraid of making a spectacle of myself, and I was deathly afraid, almost from the beginning, that somebody would find out when I was drinking and how much I was drinking, because I had a secret. I had a ghastly secret that during my career of going to doctors, I could not share. I would not share. And my secret was this. I had to drink. I had to drink to live. Now, I knew this, and I was very ashamed of it. But I was absolutely panic-stricken at the thought that somebody would find out, and when they found out, they would try to remove me from the bottle. And then, of course, I couldn't live. At least that was what I believed. After the war, we settled down outside of Boston. And I had figured that life was going to be very different when he came back from service and when we established our own home. Our own home was a two-room apartment. It wasn't very long before that two-room apartment wasn't quite big enough for us because the family increased. And the family increased suddenly one Sunday morning by two, which was great because the doctors had told me I never could have any children, so I had twins. But these two little boys were born 3 months early, and they weighed 2 pounds apiece. Now, in those days, any baby born under those circumstances and living was unheard of. And so the doctors told me after their birth that I couldn't see them. They were in an incubator. I could not see them. And they had a million-to-one chance to live for 24 hours. This was, to say the least, a blow. I'd always had pretty much what I wanted all my life, and the doctors were saying no, and I have great respect for the medical profession, and Daddy couldn't buy it for me, and I couldn't con it, so I was kind of out of luck. I was overwhelmed. I didn't know I was going to have twins either. That part was overwhelming, too. So that morning, very, very seriously, and very, very fervently, I did something I had not done before in my life in this way, certainly. I asked God if I could keep those babes. I told him I would be the best mother I could be. You know a funny thing? I remember that so well, and I tell you now, it's almost 30 years ago. I remember it so distinctly. And I remember the thought that went through my head as I was saying that, because I started to say the best mother in the world, and something stopped me. I said the best mother I could be. And I came to remember that many, many times in the next few years. God was very good, and the babes did live. Both the boys are just great, absolutely great. And they have been the joy of my life. And I was not a good mother, and I wanted to be. This is the thing I think that other people, earth people, do not understand about alcoholic parents. We want so much, to do so much for our children. We love them just like anybody else does. But then suddenly we become helpless, and I became helpless. My helplessness, fortunately, did not start initially, because if it had, I do not believe I would have been able to go through their first year, which required 24-hour care. I drank, but I drank very carefully. I drank every day. But I spaced it very carefully, and I wasn't particularly afraid of it because my whole mind and body and heart and soul was on taking care of these babes and pulling them through, seeing if they didn't get any germs or illness or anything that was going to threaten them. And so we passed through the first year, and we passed through the second year, and they were thriving. And before we had completed the third year, their father had died. What I know now was an alcoholic suicide. Now, this is a dreadful thing to go through. And I went through it, of course. I'm not going too much into any of the details of the event itself. But my reaction was, I do not believe, a routine reaction, a normal reaction, because my reaction was one of anger. How could he do this to me? I had never in my life had a cross word from this man. I knew he loved me, and I knew he loved the children, and I could not understand the act. I did not understand it until after I came to AA, and believe me, I am grateful for my understanding. Because there is guilt associated with this that can't help but be. And I had guilt, and I didn't know what I was guilty of. When my dad had come over that morning, after my frantic call to him, and he handled the police and all the details, and he came in from the car where this had happened. He came in from the car, and he handed me a bottle of Muscatel that was about half full. Now, that didn't register with me at all then. And Daddy gave it to me, and he said, I thought I'd better bring this into you before the police came. He put it in the pantry. And you know what? I drank it. Before that day was over, I finished that bottle. And I think I finished it in anger. And it was a long time before I could look back and see what I had done and realize why I had done what I had done. I couldn't help it. Nor could I help the anger. I had every reason at that point to submerge myself into alcohol, and my parents would have supported me to the utmost with whatever I did then. But I didn't, because there was something then even more important to me than the next drink, and that was still the boys. I didn't know how I was going to support them financially and take care of them physically. They were 3 years old. And I could not figure out how I was going to solve these problems, but the problems were so great, and the chores of the moment all were so great, that I did not have an opportunity or a desire to change my drinking. I drank in the evening after they had gone to bed, and I nursed a little bit during the day, and I did not get drunk. Until, lo and behold, within a year, I was married again to a very fine man that turned out to be a wonderful, wonderful stepfather for those children. And he provided us with all the things I thought I wanted, a nice home, a car, enough money to buy the groceries, etc. And, oh boy, John was a bachelor of about 35 or 6 or so, I guess, when we were married. And all his life, he hadn't had too much use for either women or children, so he marries a widow with 3-year-old twins. He didn't know what was in store for him. It was a very short time after that, and there's no relation between these things at all. I think alcohol is going to progress at its own pace pretty much. I don't think we can stop it or start it or do much about it. But it was after this, when everything's going along smoothly, that my drinking pattern changed. Until one morning I came home from taking John to the train, and I rushed into the kitchen. The kids hadn't had their breakfast or dressed or anything. And I rushed into the kitchen. I took a bottle of wine, and I poured a glass. I was still using glasses. I poured a glass, and I plopped the bottle down on the counter, and I said aloud, Midge, this is wrong. And then I drank it. That was my first awareness of a compulsive drink. I didn't call it that, but I knew I drank because I had to. I knew I had no choice. And I drank with guilt. And I never had another drink in my life without guilt. I became extremely ill with the wine drinking all day, and any of you who've had the wine illness know what I mean. Oh, John started sending me to doctors and going with me. There were doctors, there were psychiatrists, there were a couple of clergymen. I was supposedly suffering from some kind of a psychosomatic illness. Boy, I played that to the hilt. I never told anybody, and nobody asked me. Not one of these men asked me how much I drank, and I don't know whether I would have been honest or not. But after a certain amount of this routine, I got feeling so terribly guilty about it. Here, this good man, I knew I was giving him a bad time, and he didn't know what the cause of it was, nor did he know how much I was drinking. So I decided that I was spending his money. It wasn't doing any good because I knew the truth. The truth was the wine, so I better give it up. So I made this rash decision to never have another drink of wine as long as I lived, and I haven't. But you see, being alcoholic, immediately I thought, gee, it must be the grapes in the wine. It's too acid for my system. So I switched to whiskey. I had 3 more years to go on the whiskey routine, and the descent was very rapid because I didn't change my timing. As a matter of fact, I shortened the time between drinks and I increased the amount. So by the time I came to AA, I was on quite a schedule. I had a fifth of whiskey from 7 in the morning to 7 at night, another fifth from 7 at night to 7 in the morning. 7 o'clock was the deadline date, and I didn't know that it was night or morning, and I didn't care. The hardest part, I think, was the conscious or the knowing the neglect of the children. I wasn't doing their laundry. They learned to do their own laundry at about age 7. John, who had never boiled water before, became quite a cook. Mother was sick. Mother was sick, and believe me, Mother was sick. I would be sick for days on end, and I could always con John. I'd say, I can't keep anything down. I don't know what's the matter with me. The doctor's coming. He didn't know either. And I said, the only thing, if you bring me a little cheese glass with about that much whiskey in it and just float some water on the top, you know, I think maybe I could keep that down. Sure, I could keep it down. I'd been practicing on it all day, but he was around and like watching me, and the only way I could get it was to ask for it. So I had to, and life was like this, making up one lie after another. I had a great habit of when I couldn't function anymore around the house, I was sick and I went to bed. And the idiots around me, I use the word idiots lovingly, all put up with this. It was frightening them, and John thought I was losing my mind, which of course is all too true. I was losing my mind. But I didn't know it then, nor did he. And here again, this thing, why do I do it? Why can't I stop? Why can't I live like other people do? Why can't I take the children out to the playground, or why can't I play with them? Or the withdrawal from people was a horrible thing because I liked people. And I loved my parents, and I withdrew from them. I loved being involved in church and PTA activities, and I withdrew from them. I withdrew from the girls in the neighborhood with the coffee clutches and so forth, and I told terrible lies about them, every one of them, as I dropped one friendship after another, because the girl was getting too close to me. She was getting too close to the truth. She was going to come in, walk in my back door someday and find me going with the bottle, because that's the way it was then. The glasses had long since gone. And I was panicky of being discovered. And so I told terrible lies to my husband about these girls, and I picked a horrible fight with the girl herself until I divorced myself of all my friends and hated it because the loneliness was becoming absolutely unbearable. I wanted to be alone, I said, and boy, I was alone. And it was all really my own choice, just from fear of discovery. In those days, I had a dream, and I had it night after night after night. It was an awake dream, not a sleeping dream. And I knew what I wanted to be, and I knew how I wanted to be, and I knew what I wanted to do. And so I dreamed my dream every night, and it went like this. Now tomorrow, I will get up nice and bright and early, And I will fix breakfast for the family. Then as soon as they have all gone off to school and to work, I'll do the dishes, I'll make the beds, I'll vacuum the house, I'll do the washing. I'm going to do things now I haven't done for months, you understand. But I know I'm going to do them all in one day. Then, when all that is finished, and before it's time for the kids to come home, I'll make cookies. Now, every good mother makes cookies for her dear little kids. And when they come home, I will tell them they can invite all their nice little friends in for milk and cookies. I hated kids in groups of more than one. But this was the plan, and I'm going to be all nicely, freshly dressed with my hair combed and even lipstick on and a nice, fresh dress. I don't think I own such a thing. And this is what's going to happen tomorrow when I went to bed at night. Tomorrow. So I wake up, and I start to put my plan into operation. And I go out in my dirty bathrobe to the kitchen where people are just leaving. Breakfast is over. Because naturally I had to plan it that way, didn't I, in the morning? So they go, and then I start to put the plan in operation, and I get up to take a coffee cup and saucer from the kitchen table over to the sink. It rattles. I can't hold it. And so I sit down. But you see, there's a cure for that. Now, I know the cure. I've known the cure for years. And so, of course, I can't start on my plan until I have a drink. So I have a drink that's going to cure the shakes. And a funny thing happened. It didn't quite cure the shakes. You know what I mean? It didn't quite. So I had to have another drink. 2:30 that afternoon, I'm back in the bed I was going to make. And a little something is shaking me. And a little voice is saying, "Mommy, you haven't got a headache again." And I could die. I didn't want it that way. John used to tell me that he always wished that when he got off the train at night, he knew what I was going to pick a fight about because he could be prepared. Well, that would have been self-defeating had he known. I made sure he didn't know because I was pretty good at thinking him up, whatever came at the spur of the moment that I could turn on him for. I don't know why in the world this man stayed with me. I really don't, but he's still with me. Thank God. But I would pick a fight with him. And then I would go into my room. I'd moved out of his room a couple of years prior to this because he almost caught me drinking in the middle of the night one night, so I moved out. I would go into my room and slam the door. Well, now no man is going to, stick his nose out for any more of that. So I was alone and I was safe for the rest of the night. And I would stay there and pass out, drink. The reason I did it was because I wasn't capable of getting dinner, and I knew it. But I wasn't a slurry drunk, and I wasn't a fall-down drunk. I managed, I coped till the last minute, and then I caved in completely all at once. I know there are some mothers like that. It's not a good pattern at all. You don't get any warning. You just go, "Ink, it's over, out." And I didn't ever know whether I was sleeping or passed out. And really, it didn't make any difference. But that was the reason that I picked the fights with him, because I had to get out of the way. And I was still this terrible shell of self-protection that I built up with the lies and the whole behavior pattern. Everything was built up to protect this. I came to one morning after what we figured out later was a 3-day blackout in which I had done things I hadn't done for months, like driving into Boston and back and a few things like that. I don't know a thing about it. Went to the grocery store, cooked a lamb for Sunday dinner. I don't know where I was, but that's what, as I say, that time is irrevocably lost, but it served its purpose. Because when I did come to, I was shattered. I'm very grateful for what happened, because I had that one flash of insight, that one moment of being able to look at myself, and oh, what I saw, what a mess, what self-loathing, what disgust, and why, a question that kept going over and over and over in my mind. And I knew that I was caught in the trap, and I suddenly knew as I looked down, the uniform for that particular period of time, they changed about every 3 or 4 days, it was the dirty bathrobe to the dirty dungarees. This was the dirty dungarees t-shirt day. So I looked down at the outfit, I don't know how long I had it on, and I couldn't stand me. I could not stand me. And suddenly I knew that I could not live and drink. Now, this is something new. This is something new. And then I'm caught in the bind, right between. I can't live if I don't, and I can't live if I do. And I'm in the middle. I wanted to die. I wanted very much to die. And I thought that was the only answer to this current dilemma. And I felt, as one of the girls said earlier today, there was nothing to live for. My future was past, so to speak. And there was only one question in my mind as I sat down at the table, just dejection itself, sat down in a heap. And I said to myself, now are those boys going to be better off with a hopeless drunk for a mother, which they have, or with no mother at all? And I voted out. I never really answered the question. Of course, the only deterrent was the boys, and I thought, can I leave them this heritage? But if I don't, then what is their heritage? And so, a strange thing happened. I walked into the den, and I took out the telephone book, and I called the first number in the book. I don't know why. I did not know what I was calling. This was in April of 1955, and to my conscious knowledge, I had never heard or read anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. So God struck me right smack over the head. And this I believe. Anyway, I called, and the number was listed as simply AA, which I hadn't read. I think I was listening in my trying in my panic to call to the sound of another voice. It could have been the operator, anything, to know there was somebody else alive and maybe sane in the world. I didn't dare call my mother. I'd done that too many times. And that's the only way I can reconstruct what happened. But anyway, it was listed as AA. It was the Boston Central Office. And this gal said, my name is Peggy and I'm an alcoholic. Well, I couldn't believe it. I didn't know where this was, what this was. Who was she? Where did she come from? What was this voice? Well, I knew what she meant. Strangely enough, there's something inside us. I knew what she meant when she said she was an alcoholic. And this completely unnerved me, and I cried, and Peggy talked, and somewhere along the line, she asked me if I'd see a couple of gals, if she could find anybody to send over. It's not easy to find 12-steppers sometimes, you know. Well, she did, and two gals showed up. I, of course, said yes. Two gals showed up, and I thought they were going to be social workers. Either that or they were going to be from Skid Row, and I thought, what'll the neighbors say if two girls from Skid Row come in? I had quite a picture of what those girls would look like. And then there was the social worker variety. So I peered out the window, and I didn't change my costume because I couldn't. I was shaking too much. And a Cadillac drove up, and two lovely girls got out. And I thought, oh, gee, they must have the wrong house. This can't be for me. They didn't have the wrong house, of course. So they came in, and Ada, who became my sponsor, was the spokesman. She had been around a little longer. She was 2 years sober then. And Ada told me her story. Well, mine was nothing compared to Ada's, because Ada was an outside drinker, and she had some colorful stuff. Oh, I thought that was just great. I ate it up. I couldn't believe that this lovely-looking girl with a pretty yellow sweater and the nicely combed hair and the lipstick on, I couldn't believe that she was what she was telling me about herself, that could be the same person. And yet there was such a ring of truth as she talked that it had to be. It had to be. And, of course, I believed her. And so I said, Ada, how do you get sober? And she smiled. She's got a funny, crooked little smile. And she said, honey, you stop drinking. Well, I said, you mean now? And she said, yes, now. She didn't say, do you want to? She didn't mess around with anything. She was just nice and direct. And she said, yes, now. But then she said, but we will help you. We will help you. Imagine that. These people I had never seen until a few minutes before were going to help me. I didn't know how, and I don't know whether she did at the moment. We talked a little bit, and I don't remember anything else about it except something was said about going to a meeting when I was well enough to go. And I wasn't well enough, and nobody said anything about drying out places or pills or anything. She just said, don't drink. She said, ask God to help you. She didn't ask me whether I believed either. Maybe she did, but I don't remember. But here again, I would say she was direct. Ask God to help you through the day. And when you are successful, not if, when you're successful, thank him at night. And I loved that. I just loved it. And it really, I was looking forward so much to thanking God at night that I think it helped me to stay sober. Because I'd asked God for lots of things, including letting me keep the kids. And I don't think I had ever said thank you. I think once what I wanted was accomplished, I began to take it for granted. And my sobriety, I didn't. I started in that day. And, oh, brother, I was sick. I paced. I walked up and down, and I walked up and down, and I walked up and down. In that little one-story house, the wore a path out on the floor because I couldn't sit down, lie down, do anything. Fidgety, itchy. Ada had said, now, if you want a drink, have it. Hey, how about that? I thought that was great. So she said, just be sure there's no alcohol in it. You might be thirsty. And so I filled myself up with all kinds of non-alcoholic things to drink, like V8, which I loved at that time. I had to have things that had taste to them. And that started my love affair with coffee and fruit juices and things of that sort. I couldn't eat, but I did manage to keep on drinking things, and that helped with the old habit pattern somehow. I went to my first meeting with Ada and her husband about 3 days later, and I was very curious about this. I wanted to see what all the drunks were like. And so when they came to get me, my husband said, just as we were going out, he said, I wish you wouldn't go. And I don't know why, but I turned around and snapped at him. He said, John, I don't give a damn what you want. This I have to do for myself. And I don't know where it came from, but it was so right. We went to that meeting, and there was only one person there that looked anything like a drunk, and that one had had to be carried in because her legs wouldn't work. She couldn't walk. Guess who? I was quite obvious. A wonderful thing happened in that neck of the woods. They have a book raffle at every meeting, and they raffled off the big book, and the man sitting in back of me, an old-timer, won it. And he said, is there a newcomer in the hall? And I jumped out of my seat. I said, here. And Walter gave me the book. And afterwards, I wondered why I wasn't afraid of admitting I was an alcoholic or of anonymity or something foolish like that, but I wasn't. Because suddenly I thought, everything, Ada must have said something about the book, or somebody had, because everything I need to know is in the book. Now, I believed that before when I jumped up. There's all my answers. If I can just get my hand on that book, then I'll know. And so I got my hand on the book. And you know, all the answers are still in that same book. Thank God they are. And thank God that book is still available for anybody who needs the kind of help that I needed. Because I devoured the book, and I have devoured it several times since. My second meeting, I went to with my husband. And he, by this time, had noticed a strange sort of change taking place. And the reason he didn't want me to go to the meeting wasn't because he didn't want me to be an alcoholic. That didn't matter to him. But he was afraid I was losing my mind, and he was planning to have me committed. Just in the nick of time, and I didn't know it. And he was afraid that he felt that something was hurting me deeply, and he was afraid that I would be further hurt by this exposure, not knowing anything about AA. So anyhow, he went to the meeting because he was curious. So we walked in the door, and the word had gone all around. It was a group anniversary. Word had gone all around the hall. You know, my new girl's coming with her husband tonight. You know, and I'd be nice to her. I want you to speak to her. So we walked in the door, and all eyes were turned on us. And from way across the hall, a man started walking fast, faster, and almost running till he got to us. And I thought, oh, my goodness, what is this? This must be the one-man reception committee, and isn't this kind of him? He was obviously coming to us. You know what? He brushed right past me to my husband. And my husband looked at him, and his knees practically buckled. He said, well, Uncle Don. His uncle had been in the program for 10 years, and I was so happy. And they were just great to us, but that was a real icebreaker. Because I think somehow, particularly for a woman coming into AA, sometimes the family relationships are strained a little bit by some of the goings on in AA, but Uncle Don helped us really so very, very much. My third meeting, I want to tell you about, I haven't got much more time. My third meeting, I went to alone. And Ada had said she'd meet me there. Aha, this is the big test. You know, can I get to the meeting without a drink? Well, she gave me the wrong church in this small town, not a suburban town where the meeting was. And so I went to the church, and it was Holy Thursday, and the choir was inside all locked up, and they were practicing the hymns for Friday, for Good Friday and Easter Sunday. And I thought, well, this is lovely music, but it doesn't look to me anything like an AA meeting, and the doors are all locked. Well, I didn't have a meeting list. I didn't know where to call. I didn't know what to do, so I looked for a policeman. So I drove around, like they say, you never can find one when you want one. I couldn't. I wanted to find out if there was another Episcopal church in that town. And so I went church hunting. Couldn't find it. Finally, we had a bright, bright red car. Kids had called, had chosen the color when I was drinking because I was too drunk to do it myself. So it was fire engine red that, you know, 2 7-year-olds would be apt to pick, right? So I have the bright red car, and I stop in front of a fire station. I thought, I can't find a policeman. I'll find the firemen know everything. So I walked in the fire station and into the wardroom, and there were all the firemen sitting around, and nobody paid any attention to me. Finally, one man looked up and he said, can we help you? And I said, well, I hope so. And I didn't know what to say. You know, what am I going to tell these men? So I thought, tell them the truth. So I said, I understand there's an AA meeting in Newtonville on Thursday nights, and I wonder if any of you would know where it is. Wow. The checkers stopped, the reading stopped, the radio went off, every head went, you know. Oh, there must have been 35 men in that room. But anyway, one dear young man came over to me and took my hand and took me outside. And he said, honey, I know where it is, and I'll tell you. And he told me. And so I got to the meeting. But you see, I had to go through all of this because if I didn't get there, Ada'd think maybe I was drinking. And so I got to the meeting. And that started for me the most beautiful AA career of living. Every facet of my life is AA oriented in one way or another, for which I shall be eternally grateful. I love the theme of this in love and service because they're all one. My service started very early, and sometimes people say service and shy away from the word. Service is nothing but the 12th step in action. Service is not a separate part of AA. There are no separate parts of AA. It's all one AA program. And it says to carry the message, help the sick and suffering alcoholic, to practice these principles in all our affairs. And this is what we try to do. And there are many, many ways of doing it. And I don't think it matters a bit how anyone does it, as long as they do it. And lately I have found people that I have known for years who suddenly have turned up drunk, including my sponsor, who had 17 years of sobriety and then drank. She would have had 23 years now, and she's recently out of another drying out place. She was never interested in service. And she came too busy or too sick or too something to do very much in 12-step work, and she went to maybe one meeting a week. And her life right now, I wouldn't give 2 cents for it. I love her, and I pray for her, and I wish I could help her, but I can't. But you don't find that happening to people who keep themselves involved and busy and active. There's an eagerness, there's an excitement. The benefits from service are beyond description, and my service started in a very funny way, and I wouldn't have called it service then. But in one of the early meetings at my group, the lady who took care of our refreshments didn't show up, and the boys went out and bought some rubber donuts, and my sense of hospitality was offended. Now, I hadn't done any entertaining for at least 10 years, but, you know, my hospitality is offended. So I sounded off about it. You know what happens to people who do that. Do it. So they gave me the job of, I undertook the job of making a cake. So I started the following Tuesday, and every Tuesday for 52 weeks I made a cake. It wasn't too long before, and you know, one of those big loaf cakes, and frosted it and decorated it. You know, I thought that I was doing the group such a big favor to do this for them. Really. I thought, and a lot of people made nice comments and patted me on the back, and I thought the group can't get along without my cakes. They could get along fine without my cakes. I couldn't get along without the cakes, and I proved it. Because I'd been doing this for a few weeks when I had a fight with my husband one morning, over nothing, of course. And as he went out the door, I was fuming. I thought, I'll show him. I'll show him. I'm going to get drunk today. Well, before I had time to put that plan into operation, like going out and buy a bottle, I said, oh, it's Tuesday. I can't. I can't get drunk today. I got to make the cake. Okay, so I'll make the cake today and I'll get drunk tomorrow. So I made the cake and I went to the meeting. And before the meeting was over, one of the older girls came over to me and she said, Midge, I know you usually go to Chestnut Hill on Wednesday nights. I have a new girl with me tonight and I cannot take her to a meeting tomorrow. Would you take her? They trusted me. They trusted me. With a brand new girl. I was only sober maybe 2 months. And so, of course, I took the girl to the meeting the next night, and I never did have the drink. Never. So, you see, the first thing I learned was that service, doing something, was keeping me sober, and that is the name of the game. A few months later, I went up to visit my mother, who was then living in Portland, Maine, and I took her to a meeting up there, and it was her first one. It was an open meeting, of course, and the man in the chair said, my name is Captain Jack, and I'm an alcoholic, and I've been sober 10 years. He now has 31. 8 years east of Suez. 8 years east of Suez, alone, on a ship. How did he do it? Well, this was like a whole new thing. A whole new thing. And I talked to Captain Jack after the meeting. I was fascinated, and he told me about carrying the book to foreign ports and all the things that he had done. And I just couldn't get enough of it. And he told me about corresponding with GSO. And that was the first time I had heard of GSO. And they became just absolute saints in my estimation for what Jack had to tell me about them. And then about a year and a half sober, the secretary came up to me at my own group one night and she said, Midge, I want you to take this card. She gave me a crumpled up $5 bill and a dirty old postcard. She said, I want you to take these into Boston Saturday morning and go to a meeting. She said, everybody else is busy. She didn't ask me if I was busy. Everybody else is busy, so you do it. Well, I said, what's the scoop, Mary? She said, oh, I don't know. You're something they call a GSR. I don't know what it is. And it's something they call an assembly, and you got to take $5 to get in. So I took the $5 and I went in that day. It was February and it was a terrible blizzard, terrible blizzard. But I said I'd go and so I went. You know, that's what you do. So I went. And I paid my $5 and I didn't know what was going on. They were having an election for something they call a delegate. I know they went 14 ballots. It was a fight to the finish. I thought it was all a lot of fun. Didn't understand a thing. Then they got electing something they called officers. I said it was a blizzard and not too many people had ventured out. So when I came to elect the secretary, there was only one female in the room, so she got elected secretary. So I went home with a stack of big black notebooks about that high. The whole committee went off that day, and a new committee came in, and I was on it. I went home, and when I finally got in the back door, my husband looked at me and said, what have you got? I said, oh, I got a stack of notebooks. He said, well, you know, what is it? I said, well, they elected me secretary. He said, secretary of what? I said, I don't know. See, I've done everything wrong in a day, except drink, not drink. That I did right. Everything else has been wrong. But this is the way it happened. And so I was secretary, and they gave me a thing called the Third Legacy Manual. Wow, thank God it's been rewritten, and you can read it a little bit more easily now. But that was a mind breaker. So I started studying the Third Legacy, and I played the same game I used to play in school. I put the book under my pillow at night because I thought that the stuff would go into my head while I was sleeping, like my spelling lesson used to. And I made myself read a page or a paragraph or something every night, and I read it over and over and over and over again, and I finally learned it, and I finally learned that fabulous system of elections. And I was lucky because nobody else bothered to do that, so I became, you know, the one to answer all the questions. At this time, I was also on the steering committee of the central office, which you're not supposed to do, but I was secretary of that, too, and volunteering in the central office, doing a little institutions work on the side. So one day after meeting, a man came up to me and he said, "Hey, kid, why don't you go out and take a group picture of yourself?" And of course, he was right, but people would try to slow me up occasionally and say, you know, my sponsor said, "You'll get too tired." And I was just going along like a whirling dervish and having a ball, but all the same, I was really learning a lot and meeting a lot of people. And this business of coming out of your shell is so exciting. It really is. And this is how I came out of my shell. You don't come from the outside in. There's no way. The shell is only broken like a chicken from the inside out. And it was just so exciting. Then I had a stint of 3 years as secretary in the Boston Central Office, the paid secretary, and that was really, really absolutely great, and I loved every minute of it. And take good care of your Central Office secretaries, because they're the hardest working people in AA and usually get the least thanks for it. And the only problem Central Office secretaries have is with AA members. I'm not a Central Office secretary right now, so I can say that, but it's true. It really is. Everybody else is just great, but there's a few members that give you a bad time. I had been there almost 3 years when Frank Russell, who was a delegate at that time, later became a trustee, and an old friend of mine called me up one day, and he said, "Midge, I want you to fill out an application for me. Herb Moore's just sent it from New York." I said, "For what, Frank?" He said, "For a staff member at GSO." I said, "You're nuts." I said, "Look, my parents are here. We own a home. I've got a good job. My husband's job is here. My kids are in school. Anyway, I'm not qualified. I couldn't possibly do it, Frank. Thanks a lot. Goodbye." He called me right back. He said, "Do one thing for me. When you go home tonight, ask your husband." So I went home that night and I asked my husband. I said, "Frank had a nutty idea today. Too much." So I told him what the nutty idea was, and John said, "What's nutty about that?" And so I filled it out and sent it in, and then began about 2.5 months of waiting, interviews, telephone calls. And it got down to the wire. And Herb called me up one day from New York. He said, "Are you still interested?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "There's three competitors." "Okay." Called me up the next day. "Are you still interested?" I said, "Yes." He said, "There's two competitors." He called me up the third day. He said, "Are you still interested?" I said, "Yes." He said, "You're it." And so the most exciting part of my whole life started. And of course, Bill was there then, and I'm one of the so fortunate ones to have met Bill, to have worked with Hazel, and to have had all these fabulous experiences like coming to Ohio that are part of life and work at GSO. And all of what this means to me and what it has done for me, it would be absolutely impossible to put into words. But it can be summed up in just a few words: love and service. But you see, I'm not talking about giving love and service, I'm talking about receiving it. Because from the word go, I have been the recipient of everything good and wonderful and beautiful in AA. And for every bit of it, and for what it means to me, I thank every one of you from the bottom of my heart. God bless you, and I love you all. Thank you.